This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
First of all, this is from Sarah in Thamesmead. Yesterday, I found that I am going to be unexpectedly taking a flight home to Philadelphia on Saturday for the earlier than originally thought birth of my sister's first child. All very joyous, even if a tad chaotic at such short notice. The advice I need is in relation to the in-flight entertainment. Normally, with longer to plan, I would have stacked myself up with DVDs of my choice to watch on the flight. I simply don't have time to do that, so I went online and checked the selection of in-flight movies that the airline is offering on their seat-back entertainment. Imagine my joy when I saw that the films consist of Australia.
Yes. Well, I liked it.
So yes.
All of it.
Dragon Ball Evolution, Marley and Me, Max Payne, My Life in Ruins, The Time Traveller's Wife, and Bride Wars.
Okay.
As a loyal Wittertainment listener, these are all films I have gone to pains to avoid at the advice of the good doctor. Now I will be trapped on a 7-hour flight with just these as my entertainment choice. Could you please tell me which of these will hurt the least?
Yeah, absolutely. The Time Traveller's Wife. I didn't say to avoid Time Traveller's Wife. What I said was that it's the book is by, I always get this, it's Audrey Niffenegger, isn't it?
That's it.
Okay, fine. And the book is clearly unfilmable. And to some extent, what the film does is prove that the book is unfilmable, but it has a much better go at it than any of us had a right to expect. And for all the things that are sort of just don't quite gel about it, the things that are a little bit Doctor Who, Star Trek-y, creaky in the wrong kind of way, there is enough in it that does work to make it a much better film than I thought it was going to be. The other thing was that it was one of those films that there was a sort of whiff about it before it turned up. I mean, I think we only saw it in the week of release. And I remember hearing, reports, troubled, very difficult to do. I was rather surprised by the things that were right about it. Certainly of that selection that you've just read out, it is the standout movie.
Better than Australia?
Oh, no, but sorry. I thought we were discounting Australia because you said... obviously, fine, you've got 7 hours, right? Seven hours?
I believe that's right, yes.
Okay, Australia is the best part of three. I think it's 2 hours 45, something like that. Australia, what, all of it? And it is, yes, all of it. I enjoyed Australia. Again, I know it didn't get very good reviews, although I liked it and Chris Tookie liked it. It was one of the moments in which me and Chris Tookie came together, like, north and south. And
he being of the Daily Mail.
He being of the Daily Mail. And he and I have, in the past, have disagreed, particularly over the case of Crash, which I said was the best film of the year, and he said that it should be banned. Or he said, I think he didn't actually use the word banned, he said be avoided with legal recourse, but we both agreed on that. So if you watch that, that's 2 hours 40, then you take a 20 minute break to stretch your legs, then you have to Time Traveller's Wife, that'll give you another 10 minutes. That's the best part of 5 hours accounted for.
That's probably enough. You don't want to watch anything else.
Well, you've got another 2 hours to kill. So what were the other...
Read a book.
Yeah, or
talk
you could...
Talk to the person next to you.
Yeah, you really want to do that on an airplane, don't you? Just read me the list quickly.
I don't want to go through the list again.
Quickly.
Marley and Me, Max Payne, My Life in Ruins, Bride Wars, Dragon Ball Evolution.
Max Payne of all of them, because it's completely head-baggingly stupid.
Sarah is concerned. She says her concern is that she wants to survive the flight without getting taken down by an air marshal for standing up on a flight and declaring the end of narrative cinema. We'll do some of the box office top 10 now. I suspect it'll have to straddle the news and sport.
Okay.
Because there's a vast amount of correspondence this week. Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll, the Indury biopic is, and it's a biopic, not a biopic, of course. Yeah, it's at number 10.
Well, some people have said, because Andy Serkis was on the show last week and we talked to him about the film, I thought we'd kind of reviewed it within the... People then wrote in saying, are you going to review it separately? I mean, I think what my feeling about Sex, Drugs and Rock and Roll is that I think his performance is brilliant. I mean, I really think that he does a fantastic job of, on the one hand, imitation, on the other hand, reinvention. He's doing something, he's taking the character, obviously he's doing his own vocals, he's taking the character and he's moving it on to somewhere else. The film has a very ambitious structure that attempts to sort of encapsulate the carnivalesque quality, the kind of the ringmaster quality of what it was that Ian Dury did. I know that a couple of people have seen it and been quite surprised by how unlikable the character seems, although I think, as Andy Serkis made clear, that is kind of deliberate. I mean, he was clearly a very, very tough character to get on with, as everybody seems to think, that within, the maelstrom of talent and all the rest of it, there was a lot of other things that you had to get past. I also think that if there's a flaw in the film, it is that if you didn't already have a kind of working... I mean, you and I talked about this to some extent. If you didn't have a knowledge of Ian Dury, an affection for Ian Dury's work, you might find the film hard to get into, because it's certainly not doing any of the conventional, you know, linear structure of a biopic, which is stuff happens in childhood and that leads on to then a breakthrough performance. That's what it does. He comes on stage and he sort of then effectively narrates a show about his life. I mean, there's something something like Orson Welles, you know, sort of telling the story of his life, and you're not sure what's, you know, what's real and what's unreal. I thought that worked, but I understand that for some people that might not do. I think if there is a weakness in the film, it's that if you didn't already have a certain knowledge of Ian Dury, you might find yourself shut out. You might find yourself not quite understanding what it was that, you know, that drew people in the first place. But Andy Serkis's performance is, I mean, it's worth the price of admission on its own.
Anthony Paul Murray, BSc Computing Science. I saw Sex, Drugs and Rock and Roll the other night. I have to say I was disappointed. I was bored. Mm. I was looking at my watch. I couldn't really wait for it to finish.
Really?
The performance of Andy Serkis was excellent, all right, and sometimes you felt you were looking into the face of Ian Dury. He was portrayed as a thoroughly unlikable character and irresponsible person, fair enough. But he also didn't seem to exhibit much talent in the film. According to the film, apart from a few barely rhyming couplets provided by Jerry, all the songs were written by Chaz Jankel. The film did not explore the music, how it was new or how it was different. So what are you left with? It's a biopic of a thoroughly horrid man with no discernible talent, unless you include selfishness, that achieved two hit singles through the talents of a young keyboard player, which brings forth the question, why should a film be made about such an unextraordinary individual? Of course, we know that Dury had talent, and he wrote music, and his fans and his close friends were devoted to him. None of this is evident, however, from the film. Only hardcore fans of Dury will get anything from this film, and over 30 years after the release of Rhythm Stick, I think it needs a bit more.
I think that's really harsh, because I think the talent is in the writing. I don't think it's like a couple of rhyming couplets. I think Ian Dury's lyrics are extraordinary. I mean, he was, you know, a genuine punk poet. That's what he was. And I think it's impossible to listen to that. It's not a matter of those records got to number one because the music was great, although the music was great. Those records got to number one because the music was great and the lyrical content was what it was. If you heard instrumental versions of the Blockheads stuff, it wouldn't be what, you know, what we all know and love. I mean, even something like Rhythm Stick, which is essentially, you know, quite a sort of, you know, flippant little playful song, is just lyrically, you know, really extraordinary. He was a great lyricist and a great performer and had a great vocal style, even though what he was doing wasn't singing in the sense that you might know it, of, you know, singing in the middle of the note. It was somewhere between talking and singing. I mean, actually, in a way, you could argue that what he was doing is kind of protean rapping.
I think there's a difference between being a great singer and being a great vocalist.
Okay, fine. Okay, in that case, he was good. But that's like the Noddy Holder thing, isn't it? There's a fantastic line in Slade in Flame in which the guy, he's introducing the band, he says, and this is, because the character that Noddy Holder plays is Stoker. He says, this is Stoker, he's the singer. Noddy Holder says, I'm not the singer, I'm the vocalist. No, the other way round. He says, he's the vocalist. He says, I'm not the vocalist, I'm the singer. Sorry, I completely messed that up.
Really, really good to tell us.
Thanks for that. I'll just wave my hands around a bit
more.
Get
them completely the wrong way around. Number 9, Centrinians 2.
Not as bad as it could have been. I mean, not good, obviously, but benefits from the presence of David Tennant, who is funny. I have now seen it twice. I did laugh more the second time round. I do think it lacks the leery quality of the first one.
At number 8, it's 9. And Dr. Keir Shields, M.A. Cantab, says, just come back from seeing 9 at my local independent cinema, having loved Chicago and felt it to be a worthy winner of its Best Picture Oscar. I was very excited about what Rob Marshall would come up with. You just sneezed on your hand or something?
No, but it wasn't. I mean, you know, it wasn't.
Don't distract me from the email. I just want to know why you made that funny noise.
Because you said a worthy winner of its Best Picture Oscar.
I'm reading an email from a listener.
Okay. Yeah, but were you expecting me not to react to that? Okay.
Sadly, what he came up with was exactly the same ideas, but not as well executed, like a student's homage to his original work. And then he goes on, movies and musicals should do something which the source material that can't be done on stage. Wizard of Oz, Chicago, Mary Poppins all do this. Sadly, 9 didn't, and so on.
Well, the biggest problem with 9 is that it isn't all that jazz. And there's also, I think, I mean, it's based on the stage show, which was nothing like as successful as the stage show of Chicago, because it's nothing like as good. I mean, there are things in 9 that are, you know, entertaining, but there are things in it that are really toe-curling at the same time. Funnily enough, I met Rob Marshall, I interviewed him briefly for the Culture Show, and he was very nice and very, you know, very sincere and clearly, you know, a great fan of, you know, of the movies that that sounds wrong, a great fan of his own. He's very enthusiastic about these things. But I just think the problem with 9 is that it suffers from an underlying naffness that it never manages to escape, despite the input of people like Anthony Minghella, despite the fact that it's got at the centre of it, you know, this great actor who we all know can do things like There Will Be Blood. And yet, for some reason, reason, seems to think that playing an Italian in this movie means wearing a skinny tie and tight trousers and going, hey, 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 Italiano, hey, ice cream, yes, ice cream, you scream, we all scream for ice cream. Zach, Jack, Bob, my friend, how you say? I look that's at the window enough. Or I look through the window.
Enough. I'd rather the stylophone than that carry on for much longer. Why does that? Why did that have to go on for so long?
Because as soon as you start, it's Roberto Benigni, isn't it?
At seven, did you hear about the Morgans?
Yeah. Again, I had heard very, very bad things. I paid to go and see Did You Hear About the Morgans? And it isn't any good. And it is Hugh Grant just doing the standard off the paper. Oliver Reed once said that when Ken Russell directed him, he'd said, what do you want, Moody 1, 2 or 3? Those were the only expressions that he did, was the level of moodiness that he did. And Ken would go, I'm moody 2.5 in this scene, for example. In the case of the Hugh Grant performance in, you know, Did You Hear About the Morgans? It is simply, Hugh, can you do that thing, you know, when you're English and you're, oh, and then Sarah Jessica Parker does the American thing. And it is very, very cack-handed and, you know, very sort of broad strokes comedy. But I did laugh a few times. It wasn't totally excruciating.
New movies coming up, including review for The Book of Eli, which is the new Denzel Washington, Gary Oldman film. I mentioned All About Steve, the Sandra Bullock movie, up in the air, new from George Clooney.
Can we refer to Book of Eli as the new Hughes Brothers film?
Because
I think that's almost more important than it being Denzel Washington or Gary Oldman.
No, actually, I'm going to stick with what people will understand and comprehend.
When you say people.
In normal land, as opposed to Weirdsville.
I hear of it, but I've never been there.
Now, we get to The Road. Lots of correspondence about The Road, yeah. Number 6. Let me just do a sample here. Colman Athy, County Kildare. Following last week's discussion of The Road, I fear I must make a correction, not just to you, but indeed to the whole basis of the post-apocalyptic genre.
Okay.
If the end of the world is the apocalypse, then if there is anything remaining, it must have been a rubbish apocalypse, and subsequently not actually an apocalypse.
Okay.
If, on the other hand, The Road is about the end of the world, yes, with a father and son twist, says Colm, then at best it is an apocalypse movie rather than the aforementioned post-apocalypse movie. Will you take that?
Yes. Can I also say that it is dystopian? No, because it's not, though, isn't it? Because dystopian implies that the society is working, but it's just working for bad things.
It's not dystopian. Okay, it's an apocalypse movie, not post-apocalypse.
Yeah,
movie.
It's apocalypse now as opposed to apocalypse then.
Phil in York, I went to see The Road this week, and I would like to offer your listeners two simple pieces of advice. One, go and watch it. Good. The film more than matches the book. It is bleak, grim, yet emotionally rich, with fantastic cinematography, beautifully shot. Both the father and son are wonderfully portrayed, and the young boy is just heartbreaking. Mm. He also bears an uncanny resemblance to Charlize Theron, his on-screen mother, which is presumably why he spends most of the film wearing her hat. And the second piece of advice from Phil in York, buy your tickets individually. The only chuckle you're going to get for the following 2 hours is by asking for one for the road, please. I did this quite inadvertently and then kept having those embarrassing moments when you're all by yourself in public and can't stop laughing to yourself. It was still making me smile when I left the cinema, making me probably the only person to leave The Road grinning. Number of people have gone to see the film, bought a ticket just for that moment where you can say, one for the road.
So that's it, isn't it? I'd like to see Saw 6 and one for the road. We're building a list of these.
Dear Mark and Simon, being a fan of the book and after listening to your review with John Hilcutt, I ventured out to see The Road. I have to say, I agree with The Good Doctor. This is a very well-made and beautiful film that did its very best with difficult source material. I also agreed with Mr. Hilcutt that The Road is not a depressing film. I came out emotionally drained, but the overriding message is certainly one of hope. However, I disagreed with him that there is no such thing as a depressing film. On the same day, I saw Darren Aronofsky's Requiem for a Dream, which I think is a deeply depressing film with no good outcome for any of the characters or no feeling of redemption, left me completely cold and
empty. That is a tough movie.
Did you want to say anything about The Road, or should we just move on?
No, I guess I was just waiting for you to finish. Should I say something about The Road?
That was the gap. That was the silence.
The thing with The Road is, and again, because John Hilcutt was on the programme, we didn't do it as a sort of, you know, a contained review, is that I think that what it does is takes that book and makes something profoundly cinematic out of it. And again, everyone was saying, you know, it's something that you can't film because basically in order to film it, you'd have to water it down so much. I don't think he does. I think what Hilcutt manages to do is to take that relationship between the father and son and make that the emotional core of the film. So even as, I mean, I think it does raise a profound moral question, which is what is the role of morality if there is no future? Because as the film says very clearly at the very beginning, the earth is dying, every day is colder, the sky is getting darker. There is a sense that everything is shutting up shop. So we are, as the listener correctly points out, in the midst of the apocalypse. And yet, even in the midst of all that, the message of it is that there is a reason to believe in other people, not just yourself, which is the role I think that the boy plays. So I think he has managed to create something which is not just depressing, despite the depressingness of its subject matter.
It's complicated at five.
It isn't complicated. It's just another one of those comedies in which you know all the gags in advance and you can see all the, you know, set pieces in advance, and most of them are in the train. And there are occasional moments in it that are sort of diverting, but Meryl Streep doing comedy in that film is at her twitchy worst, I think.
Alvin and the Chipmunks, the squeakquel at number four.
Generally regarded to be not up there on a par with the original Alvin and the Chipmunks, well, the original, the first of the recently relaunched Alvin and the Chipmunks franchise. Although, as is demonstrated by the fact that it's in there, it's, you know, it's taking money, and so it's obviously doing well. I mean, it's an Alvin and the Chipmunks movie.
It's Daybreakers at number three. David Nugent writes, I've been listening to your programme for quite some time, and only after listening to your review of Daybreakers do I feel the need to contact you. Can you really be serious? Did you honestly like this? When I saw it, there were people in the theatre, including myself, laughing all the way through at how bad it was. The dialogue was shockingly horrendous. Case in point, Sam Neill, after sucking the blood of the main character, flailing on the floor, gasping, "Your blood, what have I done?" I don't know if he speaks like that. Anyway. Made me cringe. Sam, you're better than this. And then there's loads and loads and loads of that.
Sam Neill, you know, is not above some ripe acting. I mean, for example, I mean, I mentioned Zuofsky's Possession. Watch Sam Neill in that. I mean, his acting in that is ripe and then some. No, I did. I thought that there was some. I mean, I don't think it's without flaws, and it is clearly a B picture. And it has ambitions beyond what it's actually capable of. But no, I thought it was an interesting idea. I like the idea of a world in which everyone is a vampire, and consequently the source of food, i.e. unvampired humans, is running out.
We have Sherlock Holmes at number two, and Will in Munich says, having listened in last week and heard Keith likening your relationship to that of Holmes and Watson, one being extremely brilliant but not particularly likeable, and the other being not quite so brilliant but extremely likeable, I'd like to point out that this isn't quite true. Both of you are extremely brilliant and immensely likeable. Best wishes, Will. P.S. Give my regards to Jeff Hoon. Which, funnily enough...
Are you going to do that?
No, I'm not.
Okay, fine. Okay.
Anyway, Sherlock Holmes at number two.
Yeah, Guy Ritchie's best film by a million miles. Also Guy Ritchie's least Guy Ritchie film.
And the UK's number one is still Avatar. Just a few quickies on this. David Powell, just come out of Avatar. Absolutely loved the wild roller coaster ride that Cameron presented on the screen, but the adrenaline rush led to a feeling of anger come the final scene. My father was a Royal Marine. Later in life, he developed MS and was wheelchair bound. That's David's phrase. My line of work now involves working with the Paralympians. What Cameron seems to have omitted amongst the moralising about the environment and Western foreign policy is, particularly at the end, any form of human redemption. Whilst we'd all love to be part of that world, ultimately, when we take off our 3D glasses, we are human. Some of us, like my father, have much to offer society. Therefore, my overall feeling about Cameron's is, despite his extraordinary work, one of resentment.
What do you make of that? Well, because his argument, therefore, being that because the what happened...
Hold on.
We can't, because I don't want to give away the ending of the film, because heaven knows I get accused of doing enough plot spoilers as it is. I have to say that when I saw it, that didn't strike me as a problem. Now that you say it, I can see that it could be interpreted like that. I think you could equally interpret it as being a film which says you should never see somebody as being the limits of their physical abilities, that people are not different. Because, in fact, there is some suggestion at the beginning of the film that that character is being seen as a wheelchair-bound character. But actually, I think the thrust of the movie is that isn't what defines him. That's not to say that you can't read it other ways. I think that clearly... But, I mean, you only have to look, for example... at the number of different political interpretations that have been put on the film. I mean, there's a thing in America at the moment that some people have taken very much against the film and called it virtually communist propaganda because of what they see as its, you know, as its general message that, you know, going into other countries and blowing them up in order to have all their resources is probably not good.
Well, we talked about this when it came out. I said it was like a subversive movie.
That stuff is writ large. I mean, and it's perfect, but there's any number of ways of reading those things. I mean, I generally think that Cameron, his heart is in the right place in those areas, but I also think that he paints with such broad strokes that it is possible for him to make, you know, for him to do things that people could read as problematic, as clearly that, what was the guy's name?
David.
As clearly David had done. And also I defer to your, you know, your personal knowledge of this.
So, and just one more finally on Avatar, still the UK's number one, Mark in Stafford. I saw Avatar on the opening day in 2D, and in 2D you soon get used to the visual wow factor, and so other elements, narrative, characters and storytelling, take the responsibility of entertaining you for most of the 3 hours, and they fail miserably. The film is boring and overlong, the script is patronising to the viewer, as each new character enters the film, they take 5 minutes to explain exactly who they are, how long they've been there, and what their thoughts are on the situation. The action sequences are well put together, but the rest of the film is so boring.
And as you yourself said, you could get anyone and introduce them to the characters and go, OK, draw the character arc for me and tell me what's going to happen, where they're going to end up and how it's going to happen, and pretty much it does all of the above.
100% all the way through. We have some movies to discuss, some new ones indeed, and you might have noticed from your local poster site there's a new George Clooney film around.
There is, yeah, up in the air, up for several awards, including several Golden Globes, Best Picture, Best Actor for George Clooney, Best Supporting Actress twice, Anna Kendrick, Vera Farmiga.
You're the critic.
Let's call the whole thing off.
You might have looked it up before you came.
How am I going to look up how to pronounce the name?
The moviegoers pronunciation guide.com.
Fine. Well, while I'm doing the review, you look up Vera Farmiga on that, and I'll review the film. So the story. This has been described as a very timely satirical comedy to do with the recession. Of course, one should always remember that because of the way that movies work and because of how long it takes to make a movie, if any movie is timely, it's almost certainly by accident. Because when you start making movies, you don't actually know what the economic climate is going to be like by the time they finally get released.
How do you spell hers? Oh, I've got it. Don't
Farmiga. Worry. Have you actually got a site called...
Carry on.
Okay, fine. So the story...
I'm still on images, which is a bit disturbing.
You have to
I better
come
skip
off.
Over
okay,
this bit.
Fine. So George Clooney is Ryan Bingham, who's basically, his job is that he spends his life travelling the world on aeroplanes, executive class, being sent to distant locations to fire people. I mean, travelling around America, like to go and fire people. His job is that he works for a company which essentially handles the business of firing people. And this is nominally because the company understands the people management and the complexities involved in this sort of thing. Of course, it's actually because the companies themselves are too chicken to fire their own staff. So they get in George Clooney to fire them. Have you got a result there? You're giving me that look which says I have a result.
No, it's still far. It's certainly farming. I don't know if it's gut or jer.
Okay, fine.
Because I don't understand phonetics.
No, because you're rubbish. Okay, so anyway, that's what he does. He travels the world firing people. And he's really, really at home with his job. He loves his job. He loves the whole business of the fact that he seems to live in an airport. He loves the fact that he lives out of his suitcase. He loves hotels. He loves the fact that he's got executive cards. He loves the fact that when he presents his card, they have to say, "Oh, hello, sir. Welcome back." And that's what he likes. He likes the fact that his existence is basically without baggage, without responsibility, without people. Then what happens is the company that he works for decides that, in fact, the future is not in sending people out around the world. I mean, he's aiming to rack up 10 million air miles, something that apparently only six, seven people have done. Less people have done it. Fewer people have done it than have walked on the moon, and this is what he wants to do. The company suddenly decides that, in fact, sending people off to go and fire these people isn't the best way of doing it. The best way of doing it is that they should do it by an internet link. So they just sit in front of a screen and fire people by the screen. And there's a new woman who comes in, Anna Kendrick, who says, "This is what we should do. This is the future." George Clooney says, no, that's not the way to do it. It has to take the personal touch. And to prove the point, he is sent out on the road with this young new arrival. So there's the odd couple put together. The guy who is completely sort of at home with this totally alienated world of airport lounges and hotels, and the young and still to some extent slightly naive newcomer who believes that there is a radical new way of firing people. And together they thrash out their differences. Here's a clip.
You never want to get married.
Nope.
Never want kids.
Not a chance.
Ever.
Never. Is that so bizarre?
Yes. Yes, it is.
I just don't see the value in it. All right, sell it to me.
What?
Sell me marriage.
Okay, how about love?
Okay.
Stability? Just somebody you can count on?
How many stable marriages do you know?
Somebody to talk to? Someone to spend your life with?
I'm surrounded by people to talk to. I doubt that's going to change.
How about just not dying alone?
Starting when I was 12, we moved each one of my grandparents into a nursing facility. My parents went the same way. Make no mistake, we all die alone. Now, those cult members in San Diego with the Kool-Aid and the sneakers, they didn't die alone. I'm just saying there are options.
Now, The stuff that's good about the movie, which, as I said, is up for a number of awards. Firstly, there is a nice depiction of that. Nice, probably the wrong word. A good description of that sort of empty-headed, empty-hearted lifestyle that's done with a degree of panache and flair. I mean, one of the things that the film does at the very beginning is it sort of fetishizes the emptiness. It's all him in corridors, him in hotels, him in airport lounges. You see him packing his suitcase and, you know, living that kind of empty existence. And, of course, to some extent, because there's so much time spent in airports, it reminds you of, you know, The Terminal Man, the Steven Spielberg movie, which I actually rather liked, although it was generally not that well regarded. The problem with that is that it can also tip over into being, you know, George Clooney doing the character that he does from Ocean's 11. It's like as if the guy from Ocean's 11 was sent out on the road to do firing people. You can almost imagine that it's kind of snappy and, you know, hey, it's empty, hey, it's vacuous, hey, it's, you know, it's all this other, but it's also kind of quite alluring. But it's fine. And for the first two-thirds of it, there is what I liked was a kind of quite satirical, quite dark, quite sort of, you know, mean-spirited, which I quite liked, sense of somebody whose job is essentially a moral vacuum and who likes the fact that they don't have any connection to other people. What happens is he starts having a relationship with this woman played by Vera
Farmiga,
thank you very much, who says, think of me as you, but with, and then she says something else, which I, you know, but different. Think of me as you.
With smaller hands.
With smaller hands, obviously. And that I like. Now, the problem is that about two-thirds of the way through the movie loses its nerve, or it gains a heart, depending on which way you look at it. And it seems to me that this is a regular problem. If you have a movie that wants to have mainstream appeal, but also, you know, wants to say something that's subversive. It's almost like you can do the subversive bit for the first two-thirds of the movie, and then afterwards you've got to kind of cop out. And what happens in the case of this is, it's, you know, you take the Michael Clayton character, which again, I mean, George Clooney is playing George Clooney. I mean, I think he's very good at playing George Clooney. And I don't mean to say that George Clooney is morally empty because he's anything but there is a character, there's a screen persona which he has, you know, which is smart and smiles and, you know, there's the way that George Clooney looks in those coffee adverts. You know, the one when he's holding mm-hmm. the what else? It's that performance. I mean, it's not a stretch performance. It certainly owes a lot to Michael Clayton. It certainly owes a lot to Ocean's 11. I mean, he could actually walk out of this movie and into either of those movies and do a scene in that character and walk back in again. He'd still be doing the same character, which is fine. That's the character that he does well. But two-thirds of the way through, it feels like, okay, we need to start moving him into something approaching human territory and human decency. And then what then happens is that a whole bunch of other stuff about the family that he's kind of left behind, which is sort of epitomised by this peculiar little plot thing which doesn't quite work about his sister, his relative is getting married, and he's got a cardboard cutout of her that he's taking around the country to take photographs of in interesting places. And it's a kind of cutesy idea that doesn't work at all. But as the film decides to develop a heart, that starts to play an increasingly prominent role. The other thing is that his relationship with this woman who he's met who says, think of me as you, actually turns out to be not what he thought he is, but starts to be complicated by genuine human relationships. And the film slowly turns into a story of someone on a journey, on an emotional journey in which they learn that there is more to life than airport lounges. And then that's the point that I lose it. And it's funny how that is always going to be a regular problem with mainstream films. This is that they feel that they have to get a heart. And the point that I lose faith in them is the point at which they decide. It's like it starts out being one kind of film, and although it's not particularly earth-shatteringly new, it's well done, it's briskly executed, it has a certain brio and charm, and there are things in it that are funny because they're so sort of heartless, and that's, you know, it has that kind of that smart, brisk charm which I like. And yet when it suddenly decides that it needs to have a rounded personality, it needs to give itself more character, it needs to give itself some sense of kind of evident moral baggage, it loses its way. Compare that to The Terminal, the Spielberg movie, which is sentimental from the outset. And yet you kind of know where you are with it because it's Tom Hanks lost in an airport terminal. So, you know, it's like the schmaltz factor is writ large. In the case of Up in the Air, when it was being heartless, when it was being cynical, when it was being, you know, sneery and narky, I liked it. When it started to become human, I just thought, no.
Do you think it's possible to have a George Clooney movie in which he stays sneery and narky to the end?
I think that actually may not be. I mean, funnily enough, Michael Clayton had a good job at being, you know, more cynical than perhaps you. But of course, Michael Clayton ends up with a There's a marvellous moment in Michael Clayton towards the end of Michael... No, it's not towards it. I'm not giving away the ending of it. There's a moment in Michael Clayton in which George Clooney says to one of the characters, I'm the guy you buy. I'm not the guy that you try to kill. I'm the guy that you buy. And the line has real impact because you go, I can't believe George Clooney is saying that. But I think the movie would have been much more adventurous if, up in the air, he had turned out to be simply, I'm the guy that flies, not... but I'm also underneath, I'm more to it, and I realise that there is more to life. I mean, actually, what I want from this movie is a movie that talks only about moral values. Incidentally, mentioned in passing, one of the movies that's out at the moment that isn't in the top ten that I paid to go and see over Christmas is that thing Spread with Ashton Kutcher, which is another one of those films which sets out depicting a morally vacuous lifestyle and then feels the need to sort of fall over into actually developing a heart and developing a soul, which again, it fails. Although I didn't like that film, that film seemed to me much more one of those films, but, you know, this is a morally vacuous lifestyle. War, eh? Look at the moral vacuum on that. War. But this, I kind of had more faith in.
A listener writes, Up in the Air is brilliant. Only Clooney could have carried the performance off. It is a great reminder of how empty a jet-setting life can be. As someone that travels through work, I felt his pain. So insightful, and his assistant is great too.
But his pain only gets him two-thirds of the way through the film. And then his pain turns into something else.
Well, we should celebrate that.
Because from pain came love. He was a man alone in his cockpit when suddenly he realised that a co-pilot was on board.
Let's be honest, George Clooney has never been alone in his cockpit. let's be absolutely frank about that. Look, we've got a minute and a half to the news. What do you want to squeeze in something?
No, I don't want to squeeze something in a minute and a half. Let's just do the news early.
Well, I don't think that's allowed. You've clearly forgotten how this works. Justine is here, but she hasn't got any news.
OK, well, in that case, if I've got...
The news, a man with paper has not arrived yet. Or okay. Even a woman, possibly, with paper.
In fact, it's me, and I'm just doing an update to the news. Well, so just carry on.
I could start, but then it's going to take me more than a minute to do OS 117, which is this sort of very strange French setup.
Let's not do that.
OK.
There was somebody who is Steve Cheatham, actually, who said... he was talking about your stylophone.
Oh, yes.
Last week. Choice of stylophone, horribly flawed sounds. We heard last week this electronic toy sounds ghastly and it's trivially easy to bash out a tune. I suggest an interesting musical challenge. Simon and Mark should choose a sensible instrument each, practice hard and do grade exams. Occasional tests of progress. No, this sounds like format.
No, I walk all over you in that.
I don't want to do format.
But do you have any musical talent at all?
I played the cello when I was at primary school.
Did you? To any notable level?
No, I didn't really enjoy it.
I failed grade four French horn, which is quite hard to do because at that point, grade four was literally put you in a room with a French horn, a chair and a piano and go, which one of those is the French horn? If you can identify the French horn, they give you the qualification.
On this text, wouldn't it be good if Clooney played his new role in the style of his character From Dusk Till Dawn? Would that work?
Yeah, no, I don't like From Dusk Till Dawn. Again, although funnily enough, that is one of the films in which he's the nastiest one. The nastiest character, particularly at the beginning of that movie, when him and Tarantino together are both playing nasty characters.
You know what? We're going to be late for the news. Now.
Okay.
Dave in Hartford. Nice of you to always say hello to Stephen Fry, but he's recently blogged that he's off on a 3-month hermitude to write his new book. The modern world will not brush him in that time. Apparently he won't be listening to your show, your podcast, so therefore saying hello to him is a waste of time. Perhaps you could give it to someone else instead, temporarily like. I'll take it if the queue is uninspiring. I'm sure there are plenty of filmy sorts who'd welcome a short loan into your favoured echelons. He suggests McGee, but is there someone else who could replace Stephen Fry for a couple of months?
Toby Jones.
Does he listen?
I'll text him and see.
Well, you go and text him, and if he listens, then we can talk to him. Otherwise,
I'll do that.
No point.
OK.
You can get in touch, 85058, Toby, or you can email mayo@bbc.co.uk, Toby. What's up next, good doctor?
Book of Eli.
How's that book going, by the way? Has it come out yet?
Which book?
Your new book.
It's coming out in February.
Excellent, is it?
Are you reading it?
I am reading it.
Are you enjoying it?
I am enjoying
good.
It very much. I'm on page four. Very good. So
it's a real page turner.
Yeah.
You have turned the page at least twice to get to page four. Well done. Okay, Book of Eli, new movie by the Hughes brothers, although as you described it, new movie starring Denzel Washington. Well done for going to
Who's going to know? Do you think people think, I must go and see that new Hughes brothers film? Or, look, Denzel Washington's got a new film. Maybe I'll try that.
Well, I mean, obviously Denzel Washington is the selling point, but I think...
Exactly.
I think if you're film fans, and I invite anyone to text in and tell me that they're a film fan who therefore, you know, knows who the Hughes brothers are. I mean, if you don't, Hughes brothers, people who made Menace to Society, then made Dead Presidents, which was the, I think, one of the great overlooked movies of the 1990s, a really fantastic movie, which is, you know, obviously owes something to Martin Scorsese and Goodfellas in its sort of style, but also has in an 18-minute sequence the most ferocious depiction of the Vietnam War, and does in that 18 minutes what other directors like Oliver Stone, I think, sometimes fail to do over 2 hours. Then made From Hell, which was the adaptation of comic book, which wasn't sort of particularly well received, although I thought it was a lot better than people thought, and made a documentary called American Pimp, and have since then been doing TV with Touching Evil. Anyway, so
they're the Hughes brothers.
They're
then.
The Hughes brothers, and then Denzel Washington. You
Brian
know him.
And John.
He's Denzel.
Right?
He's Denzel Washington. Story is, and we're now not allowed to refer to it as a post-apocalyptic movie, an apocalyptic movie in which terrible stuff has happened all over the world. All society has collapsed.
What is it that's happened? Do we know in this film?
Just bad stuff has happened. There has been
whose
you know,
fault was it?
Everybody's fault.
Okay.
You know, it's that's the one of the essences of a post-apocalyptic is that it's all happened and it's all shared communal guilt. Anyway. Denzel Washington's character is on the road, walking in, you know, in a purposeful way toward the coast. We're not entirely sure what his mission is, but obviously there are comparisons between that and The Road, and I think it's kind of unfortunate that The Book of Eli and The Road should be in cinemas at the same time, because what's the chance of those two movies turning up in cinema at the same time? Because they have that premise, which it seems similar. That is pretty much the end of the things that are similar about them. What happens is that Washington's character is kind of on this mission, that he has a book with him. Meanwhile, Gary Oldman's character, who is this sort of mad Gary, I would say slightly off the peg, Gary Oldman, pastiche criminal, is running a lawless town in which he is sending his minions out into the world to find a book which somehow will empower him, will give him great power, because it's the power of words that he needs in order to...
Is it a Dan Brown book?
No. The book, it's kind of... You don't... Basically, you do
is
know...
Is it your new book?
You do know what the book is very, very early on, because somebody says, I don't know what it is, but it's got a cross on the front of it. Okay? Anyway,
right.
En route, whilst walking the earth, our character comes across various reprobates, most of whom he kills, and occasionally some very startling reprobates, as in this scene which we're going to hear, in which seems to be an unexpected post-apocalyptic nod to Rising Damp, which he turns up at a house... in which a machine gun toting cannibal Francis de la Tour and Michael Gambon open the door.
Who are you?
We're travelers, that's all. Don't mean any harm.
No trespassing. Haven't you read the sign?
We're very sorry, I didn't see it.
What's your business?
No business, just. We're very sorry, and if you let us, we'll be on our way.
George, look at them. One of them's just a girl.
Yeah, that's an old story. I heard it 100 times before.
We get so few visitors these days. George is suspicious of everybody. I'm Martha. Would you care for some tea?
That Dumbledore gets everywhere.
Oh, Miss Jones. No, but it's a bit... I know, Dumbledore's getting everywhere, but it's very, very peculiar. I mean, I genuinely didn't expect to see Francis de la Tour turning up there. It was a strange moment. So, look, there are some very... As with all the Hughes Brothers movies, there are some very interesting ideas at work in The Book of Eli. I like the idea that somehow it's about the power of words, it's about the power of ideas, it's about the fact that in a country, in a world in which, you know, culture has effectively been destroyed, the thing that you need to take power isn't... weaponry, because there's weaponry all over the place, but what you need is the ideas, the words, the language, the concepts, the philosophy to take over. And I think that in itself is an interesting idea. I think there's also something going on about secularism and religion. I think there's something about the idea in which, you know, political philosophies are based on theological philosophies. I think all these things are going on in the background. That's in the background. In the foreground, there's Denzel Washington walking the earth, and every 5 minutes coming into a group of people that go, "What you holding there, boy?" and putting their hands on him, him saying, "If you put your hand on me again, you won't get it back." And then, in sort of cartoony silhouettes, a kind of, it's like, you know, Kung Fu. He wants to be peaceful. You remember how every episode of Kung Fu worked?
He walked around, being peaceful, and then kicking people.
And then somebody said, "What you got there?" And then he killed everybody, and then he would walk
And this
on.
Is all about the book, the mysterious book with a cross on the front.
Well, that is the central motif.
Why do they want that?
Were you listening to what I just said?
Yeah.
Because what we know is it's the idea that somehow this book will give its owner some incredible power. At least that's what the Gary Oldman character thinks, because the message at the back of it is somehow, in order to take power, it's not weaponry that you need, it's words, it's language, that language defines reality. So as I said, that is the background noise of the film.
Thank you.
The foreground noise of the film is some kind of very, very sort of cartoon. I mean, bear in mind, because you know, obviously their connection with From Hell anyway, they're in this milieu, some sort of fight sequences which are played out, I mean, occasionally they're played out in silhouette in ways that look a little bit like some of the graphics from Sin City. I don't think it's the Hughes Brothers' best work by quite a long way, but like all the Hughes Brothers films, it is very, very personal and particular to them. And it's not just another knockoff apocalypse movie. It's odd. It has an and Malcolm McDowell performance, which seems to me to be completely... you have to have that if you're going to do a post-apocalyptic, or as we now have to refer to them, apocalyptic movie. It's not without flaws. It's very strange. But I like the Hughes Brothers very much, and there is enough in it to make me want to sit there and watch the rest of it, even when it was kind of shambling in strange ways.
This email says, "Dear Doctor and the Medic, I will happily bask in the reflected glory if you say hello to Toby Jones for a few weeks."
Okay.
Yours vicariously,
Toby Jones.
Toby Jones.
Can I just say the other two things about
hello, Toby.
It? When they get at Frances de la Tour's house, she makes them tea, and then she says, "Would you like to hear a record?" And she pulls out a 78 waxing of Ring My Bell by... Is it Anita... What's she called?
It was Anita Ward.
Anita Ward. You think... Sorry, how big was the apocalypse that Anita Ward's Ring My Bell was reissued on 78? I mean, that's a strange...
Is that your suggestion for All Request Friday?
The other thing is... Exactly. The other thing is... That, oh, that's you, isn't it? And the other thing is that Tom Waits is in it, and any movie that Tom... I'm guessing you're not a betting man... is great.
Is it All About Steve next?
It is All About Steve next.
Mark on this email, Mark Whittaker, saying, "Dear, put that down and wash your hands. I see it in the cinema listings. There's a new film out called All About Steve. A moment's research has revealed the following fact. One, it's a rom-com. Two, it's got Sandra Bullock in it. Three, its plot keywords on the Internet Movie Database include crossword puzzle, blind date and mineshaft." Goody, says Mark. "I think I might get a packet of biscuits in for this one. Love the new show, Chris."
Sandra Bullock is apparently the most successful. She was apparently 2009.
This is an amazing statistic, isn't it?
Top earning star. And reportedly the first female star to have single handedly pushed a movie past the $200 million BO.
Well done,
mark.
Sandra.
Yeah, exactly. Which is for The Blind Side, which I haven't yet seen, but which she's been nominated. In fact, she's got a couple of nominations for. This is for Blind Side and for Proposal at the Golden Globes, about which she said, "I am beyond stunned. Sandra, you're not alone." You see, the thing about being a Sandra Bullock fan, I've said this before, it's like being a Richard Gere fan. It is kind of hard. It's like one of those relationships that you're in and everyone tells you, you know, they're no good for you. They're really no good for you. They're going to let you down. You go, no, but she just made Crash. And then she makes a proposal. And you go, oh, no, so they hurt you again. And then you go away. And then they make something else that's good. But then they hurt you again because they come back and they make All About Steve. So it's been hard. I mean, my relationship with Sandra Bullock has been tough, and I really have suffered through an awful lot of films.
Is she aware of this fact?
I'm sure she is aware of it. This is the worst thing about Sandra Bullock is that the worst of her movies she's personally responsible for, because she's either producer or executive producer on. I mean, she is on this film. So the story is here, okay? She is a cruciverbalist, which is a crossword puzzler. She makes crossword puzzles. And at the very, very beginning of the movie, she is seen to be gawky and geeky and weird and strange. This gawky, geeky, weird strangeness is expressed by the fact that she wears a pair of red, shiny boots. Later on in the film, it is explained that the reason she wears a pair of red, shiny boots is, and I quote, "They make my toes feel like 10 friends on a camping holiday." That's the philosophical heart of the movie. Anyway, Sandra Bullock at the beginning is a cruciverbalist who apparently doesn't get out enough because she's too geeky and weird. Here's a clip.
Mary.
Yes?
Do you ever stop working long enough to, you know, like go out, spend time with friends?
Nope.
Go on a date?
Oh, well, I have a date this evening, sir. Yes, a blind one. My parents set it up, so I was obviously going to cancel.
Go on out on your date. You know, have some fun with him. And have you moved back into your apartment?
No. Still fumigating. But I'm just waiting for the chemicals to settle so I don't get the old brain cancer. Though if I don't move out of my parents' home soon, I'll be forced to get a lobotomy. So it's brain cancer, lobotomy.
Less work, more of everything else. Just enjoy being normal.
Now, what then happens is she gets set up on a blind date by her parents, who turns out to be an incredibly good-looking man. It's that bloke out of The Hangover. And she's really surprised when he turns up needing a blind date. No more surprised than we are, going, hang about a minute, he's an incredibly good-looking bloke who everybody apparently loves. Why is he going on a blind date that he's been set up with by his parents with somebody who apparently never gets out? And we also have to believe, incidentally, in that way of movies, that Sandra Bullock can't get any dates, despite the fact that she looks like Sandra Bullock, because she's a bit weird. So on both fronts, no. So they have a...
Maybe it's the red boots.
Yeah,
would that put you off her? Does she look bad in the red boots?
She looks like Sandra Bullock. It's that standard movie conceit, isn't it? Somebody who's incredibly glamorous, playing down, but not down very much. One of the first films she was ever in was a thing called Love Potion Number 9, in which she was meant to be dowdy, and then she takes Love Potion Number 9 and she looks glamorous. You go, she didn't look dowdy in the first. That's the movie conceit. Make a movie in which I'm the fat, ugly bloke, and then I take Love Potion Number 9 and I become glamorous. That's the bit of which you wouldn't believe is fine. So, you know, we're starting from something which is not conceivable. Anyway, she then has a brief liaison with this guy who turns out to be a television cameraman. He then thinks that she's mad. He decides to go off and do his job, fooling around the country. She thinks that actually he's in love with her, so she stalks him. And then there's a weird plot diversion in which, in stalking him, she turns up, and I'm not making this up, outside a hospital in which there are people demonstrating against the removal of a third limb from a child. I mean, it's a really weird thing. There are people saying, no, no, let the child keep the third leg. And then other people saying, no, no, take the third. You think, what?
Third leg?
Yes, really, there's a child with a third leg that people are going to remove. And she gets involved with a campaign to save the third leg. And then a mineshaft collapses and she falls down a mineshaft with a deaf child. And you're going,
you sure
what?
You sure you didn't nod off halfway through this?
Yes, did David Lynch take over the directing duties on this? How did this happen?
Why are they campaigning to keep the third leg?
Simon, I don't know. I just saw the film. And all the way through it...
Is it Jake the Pig?
Sandra, yes.
Diddle, little dumb.
And all the way through it, Sandra Bullock does
just wherever he went, through rain and snow, the people, they just always let him know. Keep the third leg.
But also, I was popular when came the time for cricket. They used to roll my trousers up and use me for the wicket.
I don't need the rest of it.
So,
thank you.
Sandra Bullock's whole shtick in it is, I'm quirky, I'm weird, I'm quirky, I'm weird, I'm a creature of herbalist, I'm quirky, I'm weird. Oh, strange thing with three legs. Oh, strange thing with a mind shaft. I'm quirky, I'm weird. And during the course of the movie, everyone comes to realise that being quirky and weird is actually wonderful. And the whole, in theory, message of the movie is, hey, you know what? Stay quirky and weird. Don't change. And I'm sitting there in the cinema going, change! Stop the quirky and weird! It's the most annoying performance I've ever seen Sandra Bullock do. And for a start, it's not like a genuine performance of a quirky and weird person. It's an actress doing a terrible version of a quirky and weird person. And also stop the writing of this script, which has clearly been written by people who are, you know, let's just say on the very, very, you know, perimeters of what's actually possible in a narrative script. In terms, you know, there's the bit with the world, there's the bit with the hospital. Plus, more importantly than all of this, at no point did I laugh. And it is a rom-com, which is neither rom nor com, and in which Sandra Bullock's irritation factor is cranked up to 11 and then well past it. But, as she says, her feet did feel like 10 campers on...
A tent with a third leg down
with
the line.
Exactly.
This email from Carol King saying...
Carol King?
Well, it says, if you can find the time, could you say hi to 70s folk singer Carol King? Thanks, Carol King.
Is that a Toby Jones, Toby Jones?
I don't know. So we could say, well, these could have new names for 2010. If Carole King and Toby Jones are listening, then they could... It might be that Jason Isaacs is going to get booted off the list.
Can I say hello to Jason Isaacs?
No, I just said he might get booted off the list.
No, but I just said that then. Can I also say that if you're a fan of Carole King, please go and get on DVD Grace of My Heart, the film which is kind of a fictionalised version of her, you know, life and times, with original songs by Burt Bacharach and Elvis Costello, among
Rurt
others. Rurt Bacharach, yes, the brother of Burt. Burt and Rurt, which is a really wonderful film and very little seen, unfortunately.
So, 44-inch chest. Now, we're speaking to John Hurt. We're going to be speaking to Ray Winston on next week's programme, who not only is going to talk about 44-inch chest, but also talking about Edge of Darkness.
Yes.
But your considered thoughts then, and I think you found the only other clip which doesn't involve an awful lot of Anglo-Saxon.
Yeah, we kind of set the movie up, but here's another clip, this is the time with Ray Winston in it, and again has been, I think, edited for content is the phrase, isn't it?
I want to be alone with it.
Is that a good idea?
Yeah. All right, Cole. We'll leave you alone for a bit.
Why not? We'll have a fag in the passage. You dare get emotional.
You dare get emotional, don't you dare. Leave that out, you hear me?
Hey, Nut.
Remember, he had your wife. Nice and slow, boy. Nice and slow.
I mean, it's, as I said before, it's one of the very few films I can think of in which it says on the poster, from the writers of Sexy Beast. And obviously the writing is key to it. I think in its... if it has flaws, it's that occasionally it appears to there is some sense of staginess about it. And it's a very, very talky movie in which the drama happens within the dialogue as opposed to, you know, in action. I mean, certainly there are sequences in it that are, you know, obviously sort of physically violent and confrontational. Most of the violence, most of the story plays out in the language itself. It was interesting. I went to the BBFC site and they said that it was past 18 for frequent, very strong language. There are over 40 clear uses of very strong language in the film. Over 40, is that just like
10 minutes?
Is it like 5, 10, 20, and then over 40? Because, I mean, it seemed to me that there were more than over 40 clear use. I mean, the language is broilingly profane.
It's unlikely that you'll see it on a in-flight entertainment.
Yeah. I think that it's not quite up there with Sexy Beast. And Gangster Number One, I still think, is a terrific movie. And, I mean, I've championed that film for many years. I think Paul Bettany in it is funny. But obviously there is a connection between those three films. And I think it's worth seeing in terms of there is a world that they write about. There is a way in which they write which has a particular tenor to it. And it is of a piece. I also think, interestingly enough, that although it takes place largely in one room, the direction itself is rather well done. It does have a cinematic look to it. It doesn't look stagey. It's just, I think, sometimes because of the setting, it can possibly feel like that. I think there are, obviously, because it treads a very thin line between being satirical and being tough, there are times when you're not entirely sure whether, you know, how you're meant to take some of the language. There were moments in it that I thought that it tipped over almost into Derek and Clive territory, because that sort of level of the profanity reaches such a level that it kind of becomes funny. But clearly the humour is in there and is intended. I think it's much more of a one... It's not that it's a one-note piece, but it's much more singular than some of their other stuff, and it doesn't have quite the complexity. It certainly doesn't have the complexity or the, you know, the flip-flops or the, you know, the narrative twists of something like Sexy Beast. And I don't think it's up there on a par directorially with Gangster Number One, but I think the performances are very, very fine. I think it has, you know, a single idea in its head. And I think there... I mean, it's like...
Don't go and see it thinking it's going to be a gangster film.
No, it's not.
It's kind of sometimes the poster and the trailers make it look as though you're going to go and see.
Yeah, no, it's not. It's a language. I mean, basically, it's closer to Pinter. I mean, there is definitely a Pinter-esque element to the dialogue. I mean, Pinter himself could be very sweary, but that's what, you know, what it comes close to. So I don't think it is without flaws, and I wouldn't wholeheartedly recommend it. But I think there are things in it because of who wrote it and because of the strength of performances that make it worth seeing, even though I think it is itself flawed.
A number of people have been asking about the podcast now that we have 2 hours. We do it in two parts. Part one is available now. I think it's already up there, which has got our John Hurt interview, who's one of the stars, as Old Man Peanut. So you should be able to get both, and they should just arrive in the normal fashion. But there are two podcasts to cover our double length program. A couple of emails. I know you wanted to mention another film before we finish. Noah saying, Noah's in New Jersey. I see what the good doctor is saying about Up in the Air's ending, but would he at least agree that the film is gutsy enough not to throw in a feel-good ending? In my opinion, it still maintains the sense of melancholy that the picture started with, despite its growth of a heart.
Yeah, I'll concede that.
David saying the Clooney movie point is exactly what happens after the first 10 minutes of Anger Management. Starts off well and descends into normal sentimental nonsense in the middle and makes you sick at the end. And Jack says, just watched Up in the Air and I thought it was terrible. Mark's right, it suddenly turns into an emotional journey near the end, but nothing really happens. It's a journey that just goes round and round the air and ends in a plane in the air. One of the worst last lines of any film ever. You want to fit something else
in? Well,
here,
very quickly, OSS 117 Lost in Rio, which is this sort of, you know, French Austin Powers style Bond spoof follow-up to 2006 OSS 117 Cairo Nest of Spies. And basically the gag is that there's this central agent agent who is sort of like, you know, a spoof Bond character. And, you know, because he's 117 as opposed to 007. He's a sexist throwback idiot. And there are some funny jokes in it, which is at the very beginning of the thing. He's called in by his superior, who says, now we're sending you on a mission. There is a microfilm exists of all the Frenchmen who collaborated with the Germans in World War II. And he says, well, I'm not surprised it's a microfilm, because obviously that list would be very, very short. Which, there's a sort of long, embarrassed silence. Because he says, so, we're going to go and kill them. He said, no, we're going to go and buy the list off them. And it's funny, because it's the kind of film that it's full of jokes, which are, some of them are sort of quite close to the knuckle. Others are much broader. I mean, and it's not, by no means, is it any, you know, great work. But funnily enough, there are some, it's odd, and I said it is, you know, is Austin Powersy, and it is Clouseau-y sometimes. It's more consistently funny than perhaps I had expected. Can I just say, you should read the BBFC report. I can't read the BBFC report out.
Why not?
Because it would be inappropriate at this time on the radio, and I do have a certain sense of decorum. But if you get a chance, go to the BBFC website and read the BBFC report on OS 117 Lost in Rio, because there is a sentence in it which made me laugh out loud.
Does it need a certificate of its own?
It does. It needed a certificate of its own to be. Yes, we did. But it was perfectly fine. It was a funnier comedy than I had expected. Also, Crude, which is a documentary about Texaco versus Ecuador, which is fine until the moment that Trudy Styler turns up. We'll do that next week,
shall we? Movie of the week.
Just to be difficult, Book of Eli.
You are recalcitrant and difficult sometimes.
I thank you for that.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go to bbc.co.uk/5live.